911, what is your emergency?
My name is Jim Seward. I just hitchhiked here from the middle of Pine Barrens, and I can't seem to find the people that I was in the Pine Barrens with, and I was camping with them last night doing a project.
Are you lost?
I'm not lost. I'm just trying to, I can't find the people that drove me here. You know, I looked around for them, and I went back to the site where we had parked, and they're not at the van, and they're nowhere to be found. Like, I don't know where they are.
Their vehicle is still there?
The vehicle's still there, and I had to hitchhike to this payphone.
How far are you from the vehicle right now?
Somewhere, you know, 5-10 miles from it. I don't know.
Okay, Jim, we'll send someone out.
Yeah, it would be a good idea. I got a really bad feeling about it. You might want to send somebody out quickly. I have a bad feeling.
Spooky Town is a money pit, and no more. A moratorium on Spooky Town. But welcome to Spooky Trapo. We talk about spooky stuff on purpose, because it's October. I think it's a law. It's just something, you have to do it.
Very scary.
That's what we're doing today. We're going to talk about something spooky. And depending on your mindset, it could be spooky in any number of ways. Spooky boring or spooky awesome. I don't even know. It's not, I mean, like this, it's a horror movie, but they're never trying to, there's no jump scares in this shit. They're not like, boo, the Jersey Devil is coming.
I was waiting for that to happen.
It's subtle horror kind. Have you guessed the movie yet? Did you look at the title of the episode you clicked on, dear listener? Of course you didn't, because you're not real. But anyway, tonight or today or tomorrow, whenever the fuck you decide to not listen to this episode, we're going to be talking about 1998's... I was going to say found footage, but once again, it's not found footage.
Mockumentary style.
Yeah, even the filmmakers erroneously call it found footage. It's not, but we'll get to that. We're going to be talking about The Last Broadcast, okay? It's not the Blair Witch Project. It's The Last Broadcast. Hopefully not The Last Broadcast of Trapo, but who the fuck knows anyway? We don't know. We could be dead by the time this episode's done, in which case it may never be released.
We could get bored and just stop recording Trapo.
Ghosts will edit the episode and upload it to... Spotify, and you will listen to...
There's only ghosts listening, so...
You will listen to...
It makes sense.
To quote Stefan Avalos, we could say...
Sounds from other worlds, otherworldly sounds.
That dumb line in the intro to Factor Fiction is that we have a sound band who records sounds from other worlds, otherworldly sounds. What?
Otherworldly sounds.
Why is your flannel buttoned up that way? I don't know. It makes me feel uncomfortable, sir.
Like, dude, it's 14 degrees outside. Give him a fucking break. He's freezing to death in an abandoned Christmas tree farm. Give him a fucking break. Last broadcast. Does anybody... This is a thing that I still struggle with. Do people fucking know this movie exists? Some people do, but I don't think most people are aware that The Last Broadcast exists. I know that when it was released... I had to go through a weird avenue to buy it. Very distinctly remember how I bought this movie. At the end of 1999 or early 2000, whenever the fuck this thing came out. First off, I can't tell you how I heard about this movie. I heard about this movie before I had access to the internet. I must have read about this in one of my movie magazines. You know, I read a shit ton of those magazines back in the day. It must have piqued my interest. Then I was able to go to visit the Last Broadcast website because I knew the address. tebweb.com/lastbroadcast. TEBWEB. That's how I learned about the movie. I watched the trailer and I read about the behind the scenes stuff. You know what? This movie sounds awesome. This is right before the Blair Witch Project was released in the summer of 1999. I knew about The Last Broadcast technically before the Blair Witch, but only maybe by about a month. But I was excited as shit for reasons that become abundantly clear later. It was never going to play in a theater near me. That was not going to happen. But I did find a way to order the movie, and it was from Blockbuster Video.
Wow.
They always had a board behind the counter that said coming soon, and had a whole bunch of titles that would be coming out in the next few months. One of the titles was The Last Broadcast, and that piqued my interest. I'm like, that's coming out soon?
Oh yeah, it's coming out in 6 weeks.
And I just asked, is it possible to order a copy from here?
I could ask my manager. No one's ever asked me that before.
He literally walked to the back of the store, asked his manager 2 minutes later, it came out.
Yeah, we can order you a copy.
5 to 6 weeks later, I got a call from Blockbuster Video.
Did you order a copy of the last broadcast on DVD?
Yeah, I ordered a copy of the last broadcast on DVD.
Well, it's here, motherfucker, pick it up.
I mean, I don't think he said it like that. I don't remember specifically. He may have. Maybe he hung up. He just slammed the phone down. That was back in the day when you could slam a phone down. You could hear it on the other end. Oh, my God, he slammed the phone
down. His phones were so sturdy. That's why in old movies, you see people hit someone with a phone.
Beat someone to death with a phone.
Because you could literally beat someone to death with that phone because people slammed him so hard. They're like, no, we got to make this shit sturdy. Or these are going to get fucking shattered. It's people slamming their shit.
Welcome to Fact or Fiction. Yes, we are rolling. We are on. We are ready to go.
I don't specifically recall seeing this movie before, but the whole thing kind of felt a little familiar. Like maybe I'd seen parts of it or some of it at some point.
It should feel familiar because I forced you to watch it 23 years ago.
I'm sure at some point.
It's not a matter of I'm sure. It happened. I know it happened. I made you watch it. I made Scott watch it. I made Titus watch it. This is something I basically forced down the throats of my three friends because...
Anyone who would listen, all three
because,
of us.
Because I only had three friends. Like, you guys have to watch this fucking movie because I'm in love with it. I don't recall anybody coming back to me with any real positive feedback.
Enthusiastic feedback.
And that kind of reminds me of basically the way I feel the last broadcast has been received by the world in general. Most people don't even know this movie exists. Even now, it's an obscurity for the most part. Technically, the movie has made over $6 million in a worldwide release, which is good. The movie cost the filmmakers about $900 to make.
I was going to say, didn't it cost them like right under a grand?
The fact that it's earned around $6 million in revenue is a huge deal. That's a big success. But still, this movie has tended to fly under people's radar for 24 years now? There's nothing to do about it at that point. I mean, it's on Shudder. You can watch it right now. It has a DVD release. It's got a Blu-ray release. It exists. It's available to watch. But most people still, if you ask them about it, they won't even know it exists. You're basically sharing news with them.
The last broadcast, what's that about? I've never heard of it. Heard of the Blair Witch Project.
Of course. Everyone's heard of the Blair Witch Project. That's the movie that was released that blew up the fucking box office. And everybody and their dog has seen the Blair Witch Project. Of course, these days, I bet if you ask people like a 16-year-old about the Blair Witch Project, they'd probably be just as clueless as if you asked them about the last broadcasts. But the Blair Witch
Project... My twins might probably know about it.
But the Blair Witch Project did change the zeitgeist. It did something to the pop culture. And the last broadcast never did that. And I think it has to do with the release of the film. But yeah, we'll get to that. The last broadcast was a film made by Stefan Avalos and Lance Wyler. I always want to call them by their names from the movie.
Steven
Avcast and Locus Wheeler. Because those are the names I'm more familiar with.
Yeah, so I saw that and I was like, oh, that's cool. They just slightly twisted their own names to make their character names. So that way, when they're out in the forest fucking around, and I go, okay, whatever, Steven. Oh, wait, I mean, Frederick. They didn't really have to do anything.
But they did that with basically the names of everyone else involved on screen in the film.
Oh, everyone's first name, I think, is their real first name or a version of it. Like
close.
Stefan or Steven.
Ryan is Ryan. Michelle is Michelle. Tom is Thomas. The character of Claire DeForest is played by Mark Rubley. So that's a completely...
Yeah, that was a totally made up one.
Tony Russo plays Anthony Rossi. Dale Wurstel plays Dr. Dale Orstel. Van K. Weller plays Van K. Waller. Sam Wells is Sam Woods. And then we got Robert Wyler as Barry Williams. And Robert Wyler, of course, is Lance Wyler's father. He plays the Baroque County Record editor.
Doesn't his mom play the landlord or something?
Yes, Faith Wyler. Faith Wyler plays Joyce Dreyer.
It was just a nice old lady sitting at like a outside table talking about Jim.
Often he would be on the internet with people. As we know, the horrible situation that has come up because of the internet fiasco with him being blamed for these murders.
What is the last broadcast about, Kai? Just give us a quick little synopsis of the film.
The Last Broadcast is about a public access TV show by a couple of guys. They kind of became locally famous for a minute, and then when their fame started to kind of wane and their show got kind of boring, they wanted to spice it up a little bit by doing a live broadcast involving a TV station and the internet and ham radio, which they only mentioned once in the whole movie.
Tonight, we are doing a first ever internet broadcast, cable, ham radio broadcast, all live, all real.
That was a big deal in the 90s to be able to release a broadcast online and on TV, also an audio version.
A webcast in 1995.
And that's just a thing that everyone knows. Oh, that means it's on everything. You can watch it here, there, and there, and maybe listen to it on a radio somewhere. But yeah, so this was like an OG simulcast. They were going to go into the Pine Barrens because they're a New Jersey public access show.
Fact or fiction?
They're going to go to the Pine Barrens and look for the Jersey Devil. And they're going to make a live show about it. And the movie is actually a documentary about these goings-on. At least the first 85% of it is a documentary about these goings-on. There's spoilers in this shit, so...
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about this movie properly. You have to talk about the twist.
If you actually want to watch this, go watch it and then come back and listen to the rest of this, because we got to talk about spoilers. I watched it twice before I kind of realized there's a certain point. There's no title that tells you things have changed, but it goes from about a one-hour documentary about this case, but there's still 20 more minutes in the movie. We kind of wrapped it up right there. That's weird. But then it keeps going.
Before we get there, we need to... Basically, the film The Last Broadcast, presented as a documentary by David Lee, as he says at the beginning of the movie, talking directly to the audience.
I'd come to this project with many of the same assumptions that you have concerning the Jersey Devil murders and the guilt of Jim Seward, his characterization as a troubled young man responsible for a spree of horrific ritualistic homicides in the Pine Barrens. The question in my mind was why? Why would a man commit such crimes? After reviewing hours of archived footage generated by Stephen Avcast and Locus Wheeler, I've been forced to change my perspective. The question now for me is what? What really happened that night? And is Jim Seward truly responsible, as they said on Fact or Fiction? You decide.
But Locus Wheeler and Stephen Avcast, along with their sound man, Ryan Clacken.
Stephen, this is Ryan, right? Ryan?
Yep. How you doing?
I'm Locus.
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 He could record sounds from other worlds.
We
didn't mention it. The two hosts of Fact or Fiction, for their excursion into the Pine Barrens, enlisted their paranormal sound man, Ryan Clacken, as well as a supposed psychic, Jim Seward. And Jim Seward was hired as their guide. He was the one that was supposed to help them find the Jersey Devil.
Hey, Jim, what's up?
How are you?
Doing pretty good.
Lotus.
Locus. Locus.
Hi. How are you?
I'm Jim.
On December 15th of 1995, the group ventured out into the wilds of the Pine Barrens, and on December 16th, only Jim Seward emerged alive. The bodies of Ryan Clacken and Locus Wheeler were found by the police. The body of Stephen Avcast was never found, although a truly astounding amount of blood and his famous Johnny hat.
We did find some blood. And, of course, the infamous Johnny hat that was found.
Were found at the scene. The police reckoned that there was far too much of Stephen Avcast's blood found at the scene for him to still be alive. They didn't find a body. They couldn't try Jim Seward for his death. But they did try Jim Seward for the deaths of Locus Wheeler and Ryan Clacken. He was convicted and sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences. That motherfucker ain't never getting out. And David Lee began his documentary as a quest to try to find out why Jim Seward committed these murders. And throughout the course of the making of his documentary, he began to ask different questions. He became convinced that Jim Seward was not guilty of this crime. And if he wasn't guilty, if he did not commit these murders, who did? And that becomes his greater quest. The narrative thrust of The Last Broadcast is a journey of discovery. And it's, like we said, it's got twists and turns. I don't know if any first-time viewer would see them coming, at least one of them in particular. You don't break the narrative and the format and then expect people to just roll with it.
Oh, yeah, right. Of course I saw that coming.
It's not
yeah.
a documentary anymore. It's just a fucking, it's just a narrative. This is yeah. just, it's a subjective camera now. Completely different kind of movie.
First Hour is basically the documentary David Lee makes. Small discoveries he makes while doing his research and investigation of these bizarre goings on. I was actually reading some reviews, like, you're supposed to care about these characters, but it never establishes, like, it never really makes you care about these characters. You don't really find anything out about them.
I think you find out enough. You don't get full biographies on Locus and Steven. In the fictional universe of The Last Broadcast, their murders, in a regional scale at least, they were a huge news story. You can imagine that in that world, their past, their histories, have been shared on the news and in newspapers and in the media.
When it first becomes known that they're missing, I think there's even a clip of like a news anchor going,
"Hey, guess who made the missing reports? It's those hosts from Factor Fiction. Missing, ha! Bob, you know those guys are going to be showing up sometime the next day saying, 'Surprise, did you miss us? Let's go to the phones and we'll ask you, do you miss them?'"
The general attitude at the initial part of their disappearance in the Pine Barrens.
Yeah, they weren't exactly pranksters. You also get the idea that because their show, Factor Fiction, was so goofy and frivolous that people who watched it, they weren't going to take it seriously. Oh, they disappeared. Of course they did. It was a stunt.
They disappeared in the woods in the middle of the night. Yeah, no way.
And then when they find corpses and an orgy of blood, yeah, things change. This ain't no stunt.
"At this time, we have arrested Jim Seward for the murders of Ryan Clacken and Locus Wheeler."
Serious shit went down in these woods. They were butchered. These people were butchered. The story behind, I mean, of course, there's really no reason to keep it secret. The twist, if you don't know, you need to stop. I mean, like, if you don't give a shit, then it's fine. You can keep listening. Yeah. The twist in The Last Broadcast is that the filmmaker, David Lee, is in fact the responsible party. He is the one who committed these murders. Jim Seward is innocent. David Lee knew this. He comes to the conclusion in the edited documentary, "I'm convinced now that Jim Seward didn't kill anybody. This motherfucker knew the whole time."
Like, a second watch is kind of important, because when you know that, you go, oh, you can kind of catch a bunch of the clues where he's like, "At this point, I was certain Jim Seward was not the killer.
I am now also of the belief that the killer was somehow something more horrendous than possible to imagine."
And it doesn't seem outlandish at all. But on a second listen, after you know that the guy speaking is the fucking killer, he set this up so perfectly by pretending like this was a whole mystery. What better way to cover up your own murder than by making a documentary about it? Or to maybe not cover up, but to sidestep suspicion. If you're the one in front of the camera talking about it, how many people are going to think you're the one who actually did it?
They wouldn't think the real killer would be trying to draw attention to himself in any way.
And the case together.
Especially since in the documentary, he basically exonerates Jim Seward posthumously. Uh-huh. It's revealed that Jim Seward dies in prison under mysterious circumstances.
"On January 2nd, 1997, an event occurred that forced me to rethink the making of this documentary, the very thesis with which I had begun this journey. Jim Seward was found dead in his jail cell of undetermined causes."
I always felt like it was implied that he maybe had something to do with that. They don't know how he died.
They left it deliberately vague. The filmmakers, they have claimed know what happened to Jim Seward. And no. I do recall in the original commentary, the DVD commentary, there were two commentaries. One for the original DVD release. They recorded a second one when there was a larger, like more mass-produced DVD version that came out in 2006. But the first commentary, I do recall, they did leave a clue, which honestly, I don't know if this actually is a clue or if it's just them fucking with anyone who might listen to the commentary. But they said his death involves a brick wall. That's it. That's what they said. I'm supposed to extrapolate from that how he died. Either that's a real clue and I don't get it, or they're just saying that to fuck with me. What happened? What happened to this guy? He's dead. And then in the narrative of the documentary, literally the day after Jim Seward dies in prison, David Lee receives a box.
"On January 3rd, a package arrived at my door, which I think in no way was coincidental with the death of Jim Seward."
And that box, it's not in the mail. It's just a box that's left in front of his house.
It's full of torn up VHS tape pulled out of the reel.
You can see when he's sifting through the tape, lifting it out of the box, part of it is still connected to a reel.
So
it's literally just a busted up VHS tape.
You later find out he staged all of this and recorded it because he was the one who murdered them, smashed up the cameras, took the tapes out of the cameras, brought them back, waited until this dude died in prison, pretended to mail himself this fucking the lost footage.
The reason why this lost footage, it's actually set up earlier in the film. There's a moment in the footage that was public record. Locust Wheeler, he looks in the camera, he's like, I'm gonna switch tapes. This is footage that was taken on the night that they were murdered, and then there's no evidence that they ever did switch tapes. The cops couldn't find these tapes.
And there was this discussion on the last tape, you know, that they were gonna change tapes, but you know, whether that ever happened or not, I mean, you know, I didn't see any other tapes. And
during the trial, prosecutors enlisted the help of a local video editor named Claire DeForest to cut together kind of a highlight reel of footage that was shot by the Fact or Fiction crew when they were in the Pine Barrens. The whole point of editing this footage was basically to paint Jim Seward as a guilty party. He gets that nickname, the Killer Cutter.
The man who would later by the press come to be known as the Killer Cutter was hired to go through this video and put together an incriminating image of Jim Seward.
And this actually ties into the meta-narrative of the last broadcast, perception and reality.
The prosecution contacted me in early January 1996. They had a pretty good case against him, it seemed to me, from what I saw. But they really wanted to clinch this case. They really wanted to get him. I mean, they didn't want there to be any question that he had done it. They came to me with all this videotape, like 15 hours of videotape. This was video that these guys who did this cable show had shot on location. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this before. I mean, this was like video from the crime scene.
The prosecutors hire this guy to edit existing footage to make their only suspect look guilty. They deliberately alter the narrative.
Look, you see that footage? He pushes the guy. That means he's bad.
Having done jury duty on a murder trial, I know exactly what is happening during that sequence because I've listened to testimony. And boy, when the prosecution's up there and he's got his witness and he lays it out, you're like, oh my God, this motherfucker, he did it. And then the defense comes up and asks like two questions you didn't think of. You're like, oh, then none of this makes sense if you can't prove that he had the knife at all. But boy, it sure seemed like it was an open and shut case 5 minutes ago because this fucking expert was like,
if he's hiding around that bush and that light is on and it is dark, it was in October, which means the moon was up over there. There's no way he could
have. Some like my cousin Vinny shit going on. It's not what really happens.
It's easy to manipulate people's perceptions. You can do it especially without videotape.
In this case, when you're the killer who's also the editor of the documentary.
The Killer Cutter was hired by the police to create a specific narrative with the existing footage. That's what he was doing. It was his job to present Jim Seward as unstable and dangerous to the jury. That was the job.
Seemed like a pretty open and shut case. They said they had DNA evidence. They had blood on his clothes that were at his home. They all went there. He led them there. He's the only one who gets out alive. Seems pretty fucking obvious, right? But then later, there's some more clips of him questioning all of this. Like,
you know, in sitting there waiting for these video edits to render, I did wonder about certain aspects of the case. Like, sometimes I wonder, am I doing the right thing? Did this guy do it? I mean, it seemed to me from what I saw that, you know, it was pretty likely that he did it. I mean, he had the blood evidence and stuff like that. But then there was the one guy that they never found his body. What happened to him? I mean, could he have done it? I don't know.
Maybe I kind of fucked up. But also, that's what they paid him to do. So that was his job. He was just doing his job.
At that point, objective truth is meaningless. It doesn't matter.
It's which he literally says in at the end of the fucking show.
The media that should have been able to provide a truth more pure than ever before has somehow become the story. This has become more than a search for the truth behind the Fact or Fiction murders. It has become an indictment of truth and how it is viewed through the lens of the media. I always asked the question last, do you think Jim did it? And with the exception of authorities directly accountable to the answer, I have felt that the answer given has been, it doesn't matter. The truth is what time has made of this event. It has been good for business. often murder is.
That's the conclusion that David Lee comes to when you get to the end of the documentary. Did Jim do it? The answer is it doesn't matter.
When you're the murderer, that's the perfect answer. You just led all these people to think it doesn't matter.
No, that's the scary part. He opened the case again, basically. I mean, if the cops probably won't reopen the case.
It even said resurrection. It shows a picture of the tape with the peanuts in the box, and it says the resurrection. Upon a second watch, I was like, I wonder if, you know, 2 years later, he was like, okay, they never found Steve's body. No one cares about this. They think Jim did it and he's dead. But if I give them a reason to question it, this shit will be lore forever. And I can make money off it forever.
It's not about making money for him.
Yeah, maybe not making money. It's not about money. It was about being able to talk about it, probably.
He doesn't want people to forget it. The movie has that meta-narrative of perception and reality. And what's David Lee doing with The Last Broadcast? He's constructing his own reality. Objectivity was never his goal because he knew the truth from the beginning. This isn't about trying to find the truth. This is about obfuscation. The actual reason for him wanting to make this documentary in the first place becomes pretty clear by the time it ends. That's the part that really always got under my skin. Near the end of the movie, there's a quote from David Lee where he says,
"The mistakes that were discovered on this journey were stunning. Shoddy police work and a judgmental video presented the world with a person guilty before ever being tried. I know Jim is not guilty. I know that the truth is still at large, potentially closer than anyone can realize. It is as though the real killer planned a media event so amazingly cunning that it could be thought of as scripted, a kill ready for prime time, so to speak."
Upon second, third watch or whatever, that's when you go, oh, this motherfucker. And that's a line that you would just hear in a documentary and go, yeah, yeah. Got it. Until you get to that last 20-minute segment. And then once you know that the documentarian is actually the murderer, then those little lines are not inconsequential. Then it's like, oh my God. He wasn't just trying to sound like a fluent documentarian. He was literally telling us that he fucking murdered these people, diverted the attention, and then threw it in our faces. We're never going to know it. He fucking told us about it.
Building up his own ego, crowing about his genius, about how smart he is. He's telling you, as a viewer, how smart he is because he fooled everybody and he got away with it. The scary part is that he's so fucking confident that he's chosen to come out 2 years after the fact to exonerate the person that he framed for these murders.
I always wondered either if he felt that that was opportunistic or maybe he felt envious of Jim, like, I want to steal my thunder back. Or if that was all part of the plan and the whole time and he had something to do with Jim dying. Maybe Jim just fucked with the wrong dude in prison and got fucking shanked. They never really tell you that. Well, would you say it had to do with a brick wall?
Well, the idea that the day after Jim Stewart dies in prison, David Lee receives this box of footage, that's not a coincidence.
Right.
He literally says that in the documentary. He's giving you clues.
It's not a clue that would even necessarily lead back to him.
No.
On the surface level until you see the uncut footage at the end. First time, I specifically noted, like, oh, this scene is weird. There were no other scenes in the movie like this. And that is the first time he mentions the video editor reclamation expert.
My name is Michelle Monarch. I'm a magnetic media data recovery specialist.
Who's going to help restore all of this footage that he found.
A monster? Yeah, I think this person's a monster. I don't believe fact or fiction. I don't believe the fiction. I think that this is a person and I'm going to find out who it is. I'm going to reconstruct and do my job to recover what has been lost. The facts.
We're going to find this bastard. But then also, I feel like he had some, like him and her had some history. I don't know if it's the way he strangles her, and he gets so close to her like he's going to kiss her.
That's just creepy serial killer stuff, Kyle.
Right, and that could be creepy serial killer stuff, and that this is the only murder in the film, this chick getting choked to death. And that is a very slow, long process, and then she comes back and he kills her again.
It's very uncomfortable to watch.
It is.
Because it feels very real. Oh, yeah. Like you said, when he's face-to-face with her.
That actress, that plastic is smashing the fuck out of her nose. That is not... For $900, that is not an effect. She said, just don't kill me. You can get close. Just don't kill me. Because her face is getting fucking smashed behind that film. And you can see her actually struggling for a second. And I'm sure they probably like did a take and paused and then did a take and paused. But like her nose is smashed fucking sideways in there. You can tell it was uncomfortable. That yeah. shit is real. When he's hovering over her and her face is all smashed, he's pulling that plastic down around her face pretty fucking hard right now.
And he's got that serial killer look.
Blank stare.
The blank just... face. Nose to nose when he's watching the lights go out in her eyes. And you know, the funny thing is, that was the first day that any of those people had met. The first day the filmmakers and that actress meet, Michelle Pulaski plays Michelle Monarch, by the way. And the first time they met, they're like, okay, now we're going to film the scene when this guy murders you.
That makes sense. Yeah, you could do her scenes in 2 hours because she just sits there and talks a couple of times. And the rest of it, you don't need her for. That makes sense. They meet her. She gets the job. They meet her. They do the screen time and then they kill her.
It took them 12 hours to shoot that. Every angle of the murder scene took them 12 hours.
You need some rest in between those takes because that shit was no joke.
Very hard to watch. To this day, I mean, I remember watching this in 1999 and feeling very uncomfortable. I watched it today and felt very fucking uncomfortable watching
Me too. Scene. And I'm not going to lie. I watched it like 2 days ago and then I watched it today again. I may have hit skip a couple of seconds on that because I know what happens here. And it is
it looks fucking like someone's uncomfortable. Died. It looks like she's dying.
It really feels like a snuff film.
But you know, the really chilling aspect of that in the context of the film, in retrospect, you know that David Lee knew his face was going to appear on that footage.
That's why I thought it felt like he had something personal because he gave her the tapes knowing that she was going to find his face or potentially. I mean, maybe he thought he destroyed every part.
No, he knew.
Feels like he knows what the fuck. He's leading her to find his face so that he can kill her.
Setting up the conditions that would give him permission to kill again.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
Ultimately, that's the point.
There's no way he could have literally been the killer. He could not have killed Jim Seward. But, you know...
He could have facilitated it, or it could have just been, like I said, Jim was a fucking weird dude. And sometimes weird dudes in prison do not last long, especially if someone's like,
I like that Fact or Fiction show.
And he's like,
I didn't do it.
And then he gets fucking shanked and he's dead.
No, I feel that I can really help out. I understand what you're trying to do, and I really think that I can help out.
You can help us find a location. You can help us tap into whatever we needed.
I can pinpoint that location.
While Michelle Monarch is... Well, although they always call her Shelley, but she's Michelle Monarch. Every time you see it in text, she's Michelle.
A couple times at the end, they call Steven Johnny.
Well, they call him Johnny at the beginning in the intro footage. They cover that up by calling him Johnny Love.
We can't find Steven. Here we are in the Pine Barrens on a trip that he drug us out here for. We did a webcast, simulcast, cast, cable cast that really was pretty poor, if you ask me. But that doesn't matter at this point because Steven, our main host, is missing. Johnny Love is gone.
Right, and his Johnny hat.
His Johnny hat.
I don't know what that means.
He's Johnny. He's Johnny Love. That's his Johnny hat.
They never found Steven's body, but they found Johnny. But they found his hat.
It's either an inside joke or they want you to think it's an inside joke.
I don't know. It's just weird that the only thing left of him is a hat.
In that last bit of the film, Michelle is trying to restore the footage to find the real killer. David, he wants to go back out into the Pine Barrens to try to reenact the Fact or Fiction trip. But even in the context of the documentary, he seems like he's floundering at that point. He says he doesn't even understand why he's doing it.
This is one of the stops that the guys have made on their way to the Pine Barrens. I know this because of the extensive documentary footage that they've taken at this place. I don't know what good this will do. I think it's just to keep myself clear on what happened, you know, the order of events.
You never really get a straight answer from him regarding this.
That was another one of the points where the crazy in his eye when he's outside of the convenience store and he was like, I don't even really know why I'm here. And then you find out like 5 minutes later, Michelle's body is in the trunk while he's recording that. That adds another layer of why would you stop at a gas station with a body in your fucking trunk? Probably not a good idea. And it's not in the trunk. He has a open SUV, like an old Jeep Wagoneer or some shit, where it's all one big cavity. And you can see in there. So if a cop walked up, they could see a big human-shaped plastic wrap in the
body wrapped in plastic.
A giant plastic burrito in the back seat. What do you got going on there, sir?
It's Laura Palmer.
So when
she's dead.
wrapped in plastic.
It's cosplay.
Yeah, it's fine. She's good. She'll wake up in a few minutes anyways.
The moment when Michelle Monarch, when she finishes rendering that still frame and discovers that it's the face of the filmmaker, David Lee, meaning that he is the one who actually committed the murders in the Pine Barrens, David Lee is behind her with a camera. He's been recording. And that's when the movie switches from a documentary into a more traditional subjective narrative. It literally transforms into a different kind of movie.
Yeah. And then the last like 6 to 10 minutes, him killing this woman and then driving out to the Pine Barrens for a reenactment. That's the weird point where there's kind of this duality of, wait, we already saw this footage.
Right.
But then you realize that her dead body is what he's prancing around. Because you see the footage, and he's kind of doing this weird herky-jerky motion through the forest, and you're like, well, whatever, maybe he's just kind of pacing around, you know? Didn't seem that way. It kind of seemed a little odd. Like, if you're recording this, you kind of just want to stand there and talk, but...
What is the Jersey Devil? It's a man wandering into the Pine Barrens, never to be seen again. It's a mangled animal found on one of these access roads. Or perhaps it's something that rests within our psyche and we'll never truly understand.
At the end of the film, it becomes clear why he's actually taking that trip out into the woods. He's not trying to reenact Fact or Fiction trip. He's disposing of a body.
I imagine he was taking her body to wherever Steven's body was, because they didn't find it, so it was a pretty good fucking hiding spot. So whatever he did with his body, he was going to do with her body at the end.
And actually, it's kind of clever the way it's set up in the movie. Like, you see an on-screen date on March 31st, 1997 is when he does his reenactment trip, and April 1st, 1997 is when Michelle Monarch is going to reveal the face of the killer. If you're watching the documentary, that's
if you're in his world watching it, you would assume that it was actually the day before she was killed, exonerating him.
In that bit of footage, when he's recording in his car driving through the Pine Barrens, you can see glimpses of Michelle's body in the back. Uh-huh. That's before you actually get to the point when she's murdered in the narrative.
That's in the documentary.
Yeah, it's in the documentary. He sets up his own alibi.
The way it stops, he's halfway in between his thing. Like, what are the next steps? What happens? And I think that's one of the best parts of the movie. It leaves you wondering. For $900 and essentially no effects, people have seen a lot of movies going,
well, that's fucking weird. I wonder what happened next.
The last broadcast, the documentary, has an ending. We just don't see it.
That's true. It took multiple watches for me to find the exact point. The one I can pinpoint when it changes from one to the other is the stalker footage of him talking about Michelle. And it's just her in street clothes walking in front of a building. And she's just walking. And it's clearly from like a car parked in the street. That's weird. There's no footage like this in the thing before. He's like,
well, no.
That's
not true. There are several instances earlier in the film when they introduce other speakers, when their introductions are voyeuristic. The first time you meet the psychiatrist, Dale Orstel.
Sort of a father figure to him, I feel. Sort of a surrogate father, if you will. He didn't talk a whole lot about his family life. One of the things I know is that his father left them when he was very young, ran off with another woman. He had few friends, if any.
You see him from the outside peeking in through a window.
Oh, yeah. I guess a lot of the engineering guys, they were doing work, and it peeks over their shoulders while they're, like, twisting knobs and doing shit.
And when you see the introduction of the filmmaker Sam Woods.
Well, this Devil Hunt thing never appealed to me. We're getting into a pretty flaky area there, you know. I think the kids were asking for it with that one. Not the kind of work I do, you know what I mean? Not what I do.
He's at the end of his driveway grabbing his newspaper. That's actually set up in the movie, these voyeuristic introductions. But the creepiest one, you're absolutely right, is with Michelle, because that's
maybe that's the one I noticed.
The particular videotape that I was given was mangled, almost beyond recognition. I digitized sections of this particular video, placed it into the computer, and am now reconstructing the actual picture frame by frame.
That was the one I really noticed, and it was like, after that, it's like a different movie. It starts to get a little more candid with him.
I am conscious of one thing, though. My search for the truth behind the Fact or Fiction murders has in some way become part of the story.
Before it goes into full, like, oh, now it's just a movie of things happening and there's no cameraman. You know who the cameraman is up until like the last 10 minutes, and you're like, wait, there is no cameraman. wait, what's happening?
When it goes letterbox, basically, is when it becomes, the camera is just you as the viewer. Literally a completely different kind of movie at that point. The aesthetic of the film changes. It looks more like film.
Things have changed.
There's one specific moment that's always stood out for me. There's a dissolve that takes place at an hour and 7 minutes into the movie. It dissolves from footage of a newspaper headline to a shot of a lonely road leading through the Pine Barrens. During that dissolve from the newspaper headline to that shot of the road, it's not subtly hidden. That image of David Lee that Michelle Monarch is, that she later reconstructs.
The kind of screaming face.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean anything until the last 10 minutes.
You might even think it's like a during this dissolve, it's like a picture of Jim Seward's face. You don't know. Yeah. And then when you watch the second time, you're like, oh, that's giving the game away.
And even then, if you just saw the face, you couldn't tell which one of these fucking white dudes it was. It could have been any of them screaming, to be honest. But when you connect that to the documentarian who is now the murderer, then it makes you, I get it. Because that's him chasing these guys down as he's murdering them.
The idea of going out to the Pine Barrens wasn't theirs. It wasn't Locus Wheeler and Stephen Abcast's idea.
Right.
It was suggested to them by someone on IRC.
We're also doing something new. We are on IRC tonight, and we have joined
IRC's
the word.
In the house.
And, yeah, you can say that. I'm saying it's swinging.
That creepy voice.
They came up with this idea. Now, most TV shows will have, like, call-ins where people call on the phone and talk. Well, they tie this into the internet through IRC chat, but they rigged up some sort of text-to-speech converter, so, like, whatever they typed in was actually said on the show, like it was a voice. It really is hard to trace it, because, I mean, it's not like you know, like, the phone number they're calling from. I mean, this could have been, like, Shanghai, where they were writing this message from. I mean, you just don't know. That's part of the beauty and part of the evil of it.
Why don't you do a show about the Jersey Devil?
Go out to the Pine Barrens and do a show about the Jersey Devil. And who suggested that? D something.
There was a suggestion via IRC to...
Well, and also from the mailbag.
Yeah.
That guy D something, whatever his name is.
You know, in that scene when Jim, they light the paper and the pan on fire and he starts rubbing the embers on his arm.
Right.
You see a date is revealed on his forearm. That's a common magic trick.
That's an old school magic trick, yeah.
But the date is 12/13/95, which is supposed to be the original date when they went out to the Pine Barrens. But if you'll notice in the film, they actually go out to the Pine Barrens on the 15th and not the 13th. They don't draw attention to that discrepancy, but behind the scenes, and this is why it makes no sense to me, the filmmakers, they decided that the show Factor Fiction would air Tuesday nights. The 13th was a Sunday.
I was going to say, they realized after they'd already filmed all that it would have been the wrong historical date.
So they changed it to the 15th of December because that was a Tuesday. Why didn't they decide the show aired on Sunday nights? Why didn't they just make that change? Because no one ever says Tuesday.
Yeah, it's not like they say Tuesday night 50 times throughout the thing.
So I don't understand why they made things difficult for themselves instead of just saying, oh, I guess the show airs on Sundays now.
Factor Fiction was one of those fluke successes that no television producer would ever predict. Short on production value, talent, and execution, it maintained a following of youth, probably more amused by its kitsch value than anything else.
There's another piece that I noticed when I watched the film years ago, which I thought was cool and adds a certain texture to the movie. During a sequence of reconstructed footage, you see Locus and Ryan in the woods looking for Steven. When they find all that blood in the clearing, and then they notice that somebody or something is coming after them, and they start running, they run for their lives.
Yo, it's Steven Flight. What? Steven Flight. Yo, Steve!
Steven!
During that scene, you may notice on the upper right corner of the screen, the time code keeps jumping back and forth. There's no continuity in the time code. If you don't know anything and you actually notice that while you're watching the movie, it actually adds an element of, I would say, unreality. It's kind of unnerving. It almost looks like time during this sequence doesn't have any meaning. There could be something supernatural happening right there.
I vaguely noticed that, but I think I just wrote it off as they mentioned that they found the tape. The tape was from two cameras. So I just assumed it was footage from one, then footage from another. But I never really actually paid attention to the actual times. Whenever it was different, I just kind of wrote it off as that.
The truth of the matter is they just had to stitch together footage from three different takes.
Right.
And so it bounces back and forth as an accident. They kept
because the different takes, the time didn't line up when they...
Yeah.
It looked embedded into the footage if it was from a real VHS recorder.
It was literally embedded in the footage.
Those scenes were actually filmed on the tapes that were in those fucking cameras that those guys were holding. It makes sense that they look shitty and grainy because they actually pulled them off of the real tape.
That leads me to a point. You notice that when you watch the movie intellectually, you know it was all shot on video and consumer grade video. This was not a movie that was made with high tech equipment. And you know watching it that it was all shot on video, but yeah. It actually, we used to shoot a lot on VHS. Right. You know what that footage looks like. There's a certain smoothness and kind of an artificiality to that kind of straight up video footage. This movie doesn't have that. You know it's shot on video, but it doesn't have that look. It just looks different, and it's hard to put your finger on it.
You could tell it wasn't just digital footage that they put a filter on.
You're right. It doesn't have that video smoothness to it. The reason for that is Stefan Avalos actually came up with a way, you know what interlaced footage is. Back in the day, standard 4x3 television, CRT monitor, 480 lines of resolution. You get 480 lines by interlacing two distinct images, odds and evens. Each one of those fields is 240 lines. So when those two fields are projected simultaneously on a CRT monitor, it creates a 480 line image. Stefan Avalos found that he was able to de-interlace footage on his computer when he's editing. He would take one of those fields, flip it, and stack it on top of the other field. You would take standard video footage and double the resolution. It's video, but he removes a certain smooth video element from it, so it actually looks more filmic. It looks more like a movie. He learned how to do this himself. He figured it out.
Until you get to the refound footage,
right?
Which has been distorted double time in the opposite direction.
You know how he did that? By deinterlacing the footage and throwing one of the fields out, so it's half resolution.
And I'll say, like, you know, yeah, I'm hunting. You know, I'm here while Locus is out hunting for the Jersey Devil.
I'll be like, shut up. Yeah, you can be like, I don't see him.
No, we better not do that because, you know, we've got to deliver on this show. This is the big one here.
Something about the reclaimed distorted footage had a very nostalgia trying to get an old shitty tape to run. I worked in a lot of places that had CCTV, closed circuit surveillance, but it was a VHS and it just recorded over the same VHS for months. Well, you know, You can't see shit on that.
No.
You know, you could maybe see like humanoid shapes moving around a restaurant is the best you're going to see.
It's all light and shadow at that point.
Yeah. It's black and white pixels moving around. Having seen a lot of like old shitty grainy footage, there was something kind of cool and interesting, especially the way the sound would play and then not play. Half of their distorted face and their lips moving, but there's no sound. Michelle is trying to restore the footage. That is not something that happens in digital recording. I mean, I'm sure you could do that, but probably the only reason you would have thought of that is because that was an effect that happened with old shitty tape when half of the tape was pulling hard on the top and it's not lined up equally and all this weird shit's happening.
You know, I just realized it's kind of weird. We don't actually see much of the titular last broadcast in the movie, do we?
I did think about that. There's like maybe seconds of it. Here, we're going live.
This is Johnny.
And Locus.
And we are live in the Pine Barrens.
It's all before or after.
The documentarian cuts in. And then you hear Locus say he felt it was a pretty shitty broadcast or it didn't go well.
All before or after. Bits of footage that they're trying to do ads.
The two guys joking around about the fucking mountain spring water.
This is Locus reporting from the Pine Barrens. And I'm with Ryan, our sound man. Gee, Ryan, I'm pretty parched.
I sure am too.
Wow, is that mulberry? Natural spring water?
Yes, from Mueller's.
How about I wish I could have a sparkling glass of that?
Boy, I'm telling you, and in a gallon jar.
Jug. Let's see that again.
And it's in a jar.
The way Locus Wheeler says sparkling.
Sparkling.
Sparkling water. I wish it was sparkling.
We don't get to see really any of the actual episode of Fact or Fiction from the Pine Barrens. I mean, we see everything that happens after. Yeah, we see a little bit
we
before.
We see them setting up for the whole thing. We've got the Fact or Fiction logo, which means we're live and connected to the mothership. Here we go. We're getting ready, people.
I just thought of that. I was like, wait. Wait, we actually don't We don't see it. That was a deliberate choice.
You don't see the last broadcast on the last broadcast.
No. A little behind the scenes of the movie, the filmmakers, Stefan Avalos, Lance Wyler. I hate saying those names because I just want to say Stephen
Amoakis. They sound fake.
They sound fake. The real names sound fake. The men behind the movie The Last Broadcast, they were friends for a long time. They grew up together in Pennsylvania. They went to film school, hardcore celluloid fans. They wanted to make what they called real movies. Stefan Avalos actually made a feature on film in 1994 called The Game. I never saw it. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I think he was expecting making that movie to kind of open some doors because, hey, it's on film. This is a movie. And then nothing happened.
10 years earlier, and that probably would have made a difference. But from that point on, yeah, I guess even then, 10 years before.
They both tried to raise funds to make other movies. Even a cheap movie shot on film is probably going to cost $100,000 or something like that. You're a nobody in the middle of nowhere just trying to raise money to shoot a movie on film. You need $250,000. It doesn't happen. So you start to get disillusioned. How am I going to follow my dreams? They figured out a way. If we can make a movie not on film, but on video, and try to make it a worthwhile endeavor rather than a home movie, and we're using all consumer equipment, maybe in the process we can actually show other people how to do it. The thing I really admire about them, this is all on their website back in the day. I'm talking 1998, 1999.
Tebweb.com/last broadcast.
On that website, they actually were very forthcoming about how they made their movie. I'm talking specific. They told you exactly what cameras they used. They didn't just tell you what computers they used because they built their own PCs. So they tell you this, the complete specs of the PCs they made to do the post-production on their movie. They tell you the specific software they used. Basically, every aspect, all the nuts and bolts, how The Last Broadcast was made was shared immediately by the filmmakers.
Tebweb is still a company and it was based in Pennsylvania. So all that makes a lot of sense.
It's local, man. The culture was changing. By the way, technology was evolving so rapidly, and they could kind of see the writing on the wall, how digital was probably going to, if not supplant 35 millimeter film in Hollywood, it was going to gain a major foothold. And so they decided, sure, they would have to shoot their movie on video because digital video wasn't a thing yet. They didn't have that option. George Lucas didn't have that option until he shot Attack of the Clones. And he's a fucking billionaire. These nobodies from Pennsylvania definitely weren't going to get their hands on digital video equipment. But they would have a completely digital workflow in terms of post-production. And they did it all for $900 goddamn.
I was going to say, isn't it kind of referred to sometimes as one of the first fully digital edited movies?
It might be.
It was at that in-between time where, like, physical media had just gone through a renaissance, but it was also starting to disappear real quick with the invention of the internet.
It is as though the Jersey Devil is a monster reborn in a digital age, reborn on the internet. A demon captured on IRC logs, mangled video, whispers in the dark.
Some of the stuff that I thought was very interesting that I learned after the fact, and some of the behind the scenes stuff that was on the DVD. I mean, basically every time you see a newspaper presented in the movie, it's all digital.
You could kind of tell that that was like
not all seamless, but it's interesting that it's completely digital. They were using primitive Adobe After Effects on to make their movie. The crime scene footage, when you see all the autopsy photos, all the filmmakers' corpses, their faces covered in blood and everything, all that was done digitally too.
Yeah.
They never had any fake blood on them at all.
Probably factors into the rating. I don't know. This could have been fucking PG-13.
No, it's unrated. But
is it unrated?
I think the murder scene at the end would give it an R rating.
I was going to say, the only thing that wouldn't give it like a PG or a PG-13 rating would be him strangling that lady, because that shit is intense. And that automatically in the 90s would have got you an R rating. So yeah, that's true.
Bad language.
Barely.
Look, if this movie got rated, it would get an R rating, I'm sure. It would get the R rating for that murder scene because it's so fucking real.
I think when Jim freaks out and pushes Rain, he calls him an asshole or something. That may be one of the cuss words.
Are you a psychic or a psycho?
Look, man. I'll see you back at camp, man.
I'll see you back at camp, man.
Yeah, they played that set like 7 or 8 times, which made me laugh every fucking time.
I'll see you back at camp, man.
See you back at camp, man.
The last time that
when they show the full footage,
they show the whole thing. I love it's like a punchline where he's like, "What do you mean camp? We don't even know where camp is. That's his job. He's supposed to find camp."
Wait, what do you mean he's going to be where we is the camp? Psycho. Where the hell's the camp? This is the whole fucking thing. Where the hell is the camp?
We're losing.
Well, go find him, man. Ryan. I'm not going to go anywhere near him. What a fucking asshole, man.
And they're like, "Well, I don't know. I would follow him then. You could follow him."
And then he's running. He runs off in his, when they do that freeze frame, he's running off and his poncho's flapping in the breeze.
Yeah, that happens at least twice. Every time I laugh. Oh, what a horrible, evil man running away in his poncho.
I mean, as soon as you realize that, you're never going to not see it. Just overhead footage of that supposedly of Jim Seward's interrogation when he's sitting at that table.
Who led everybody to the site?
I did.
Did anybody else know where you were going to set up in camp?
I was asked to find a place for us to camp, and Ryan continued to provoke me and then to give me a hard time about my ability to locate the place that we'd camp. It led to an argument, and I ran away from the group.
Did you hit him first?
I don't know. I think I might have pushed him.
As soon as you realize what it is, it's the most obvious thing in the world. It's a chalkboard. He's sitting at a chalkboard. Wait, is that a fucking chalkboard? Yes. Yeah,
because of the kind of distorted effects almost make it look like he's drawn on a chalkboard. So
yeah, it's a chalkboard. It's a goddamn chalkboard.
And it makes sense.
Another little tidbit that I think is just very amusing. The actor. Well, none of these people are actors. That's a great line. The first text you see in the movie, the following people are not actors, which is true. It's absolutely true. Which no is, person yeah. in that movie is an actor.
And you can tell.
But when you meet Dale Orstel's Dr. Dale Orstel, you get that outside look of him and there's a dog in there. That's a dog grooming business. That's his wife's dog grooming business. That's where they shot it. When they're interviewing him, there's a fucking birdhouse right there. That's his birdhouse. He made it. He's a woodworker.
It gets harder and harder to stick with your original gut feeling.
When they set up the shot, they wanted the birdhouse in there just because they thought it was funny. They put it right in the center of the frame because they want people to notice it. And when you look in the background of that shot, what they want you to think is like a diploma framed on the wall. That's his talent release. That's fucking Dale Wurstel's talent release framed on the wall. And you can you'll never be able to read it because of the resolution. Then that's the point. Because they had to put that's something funny. There because they wanted. I just think that's very funny.
A found footage, but found footage movies weren't a thing yet. But also it's like, remember physical media, kids? Yeah, well, everyone has physical media at the time, but shortly after it started disappearing
because the world becomes more and more digital. And uh-huh. In a lot of ways, the movie, I don't know if it would say it predicted that, but it feels like it's right on the movie feels right on the cusp of that. Yeah, reality, like, TV and more, maybe more of a disposable culture.
Yeah, with the whole simulcast, and they were like, this is the biggest deal ever, and now it's like, well, that's just what happens. Wherever it's from, they probably have their own website. You can fucking watch it or pay for it to watch it right now.
Yeah. And that actually echoes the actual release of the film, The Last Broadcast, in the world. They kept its release structure entirely digital. They called it maintaining the digital integrity of the film.
Most movies were still on a reel of some kind.
In order to get this movie distributed, they would have to transfer it to film. And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to maintain a digital release for it. Its world premiere was March 8th, 1998, Doylestown, Pennsylvania, which happens to be their hometown. They traveled kind of the traditional festival circuit, but the only way they could do that to exhibit their film was to travel with their own gigantic digital projector. They had to bring their own equipment with them to exhibit their movie. And after that, they created their own company called Wavelength Releasing to distribute the film. My DVD copy is from the original release, which was distributed by Wavelength. The subsequent releases were all released by what you would call professional outfits, I guess. That's one of the reasons why I still haven't gotten rid of that DVD. I bought it on Blu-ray recently because it came out in a special edition. I'm never going to get rid of that DVD because it means it's one of those few DVDs I own that I'm not getting rid of it. It's purely nostalgia at this point, but I'm never getting rid of it.
Back off, back off. You recording this?
One of the interesting things about the initial release of The Last Broadcast, which I think it is genuinely interesting, simply because of how, I want to say, inefficient it is. It was broadcast, streamed via satellite on October 23rd, 1998 to 5 cities simultaneously in the U.S.
So like 87 people saw the initial broadcast. Is that what that means?
At this point, you look at it and it's a stunt. That's the only thing it can be.
In the 90s, that was like, that's just what TV is. Great. But technically, that was the initial viewing of the movie.
It was streamed. You're thinking differently. They actually had to install satellite dishes at the five venues in these five cities.
It wasn't like broadcast on a satellite company.
No.
It was, you had to have a satellite dish tuned in to this broadcast. And there were only five of them to do this. Okay, got
Satellite dishes had to be installed specifically for this purpose. They teamed up with a company called Digital Projection Incorporated that was on the cutting edge of this technology.
That's cool. You had to have a special satellite installed to watch this one movie. Yeah,
they had to have satellites installed in these five theaters. The way things have changed so dramatically in the... Oh my God. 25 years. I can't fucking believe that. Of course, it's 24 years since the Blair Witch Project premiered.
Right.
That's fucking nuts. But yeah, the after this, they basically traveled all over the world. The Cannes Film Festival, and they were the first movie screened digitally at Cannes, which is a pretty big fucking deal. But they went everywhere. But unfortunately, and this is simply due to limitations at the time, the infrastructure to really facilitate kind of a wider release for the last broadcast didn't exist. In 1998. It wasn't there. These days, it's a standard. You're familiar with Fathom events, right? They're the ones that they do all the special event screenings like, hey, you want to watch E.T. or Jaws for one night only? That's how they distribute Fathom events. Now, most theaters get what they call like a digital cinema package, which is basically a fucking hard drive.
And that's just something you plug into the computer and then that's it.
But Fathom events are specifically streamed. These days, that happens all the fucking time. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure is everywhere.
Yeah,
that's 25 years later now, and no one is projecting on film.
And
they're
not putting the DVD into the projector up there.
The way the culture has changed, the way the technology has changed, the way the distribution model has changed. Stefan Avalos and Lance Wyler, they were absolutely ahead of the curve.
I always got a little bit of goosebumps watching Jim pretending to IRC Internet Relay Chat. AKA a chat room.
With the advent of the internet, it opened up a whole new world for a guy like Jim.
Watching him chat with people while this is happening, because that's literally the world we live in, is that. And this was like just a little glimpse of it, but I was like, oh my God, basically what the world became after this. And they had no fucking idea. They're like fake serial killer dude sitting in the fucking tent pretending to talk on the internet is literally what society becomes. that's all that we do now. Did they nail that one? It definitely was a little ahead of its time for a 90s movie. And again, if it came out at the end of if it came out at 98, that means they filmed it in 97, 98, which means a lot of the technology was from like 95, 96, because that's how technology worked back then. They were jumping ahead with less, came up with some really fucking good ideas that kind of became a standard later on, like we talked.
Digital? Streaming?
No.
Internet chat? Live? Malarkey. These kids are crazy. Oh, literally, all of those things are basically standard today.
This movie was ahead of its time in so many different ways. I do want to mention two quick things. One, the man who plays the detective, Rossi. Detective Rossi.
I don't consider having the blood of victims all over your clothes as circumstantial. I mean, that's pretty hard evidence as far as I'm concerned.
He's actually, they call him AD, but Tony Rosso. He's a musician and he does the music in the movie.
There's two songs in this movie that really fucking caught me.
That motherfucker, he's a synthesizer musician primarily. And when you hear that kind of ghostly, that weird kind of reverb ghost choir music that happens in several points in the movie, that voice is the voice of Stefan Avalos, processed all to hell by A.D. Rosso. That's just a little bit of trivia, man. And the song, the actual song with the lyrics, is called Little Sadie. Jim Seward performed that song.
Went out last night for to take a little ride, met Little Sadie and I shot her down. Back home, crawled in the bed with the 44 pistol under my head.
He's a musician. The reason why I mentioned Tony Rosso, you notice, maybe you didn't notice, but he's wearing a polo shirt that says ATF Waco, Texas.
I did not notice that, actually.
He's wearing a polo shirt that says ATF Waco, Texas. Why the fuck is this guy wearing this shirt? He made it himself for the movie.
Really?
And he also made the hat that says Baroque County Sheriff's Department. He made the hat, too, because he thought it would help him get in the character.
Yeah, he also probably knew, like, these guys don't have any money. And if I want to actually make this look a little legit, I could pay $20 and make my own hat. He was his own prop guy.
As professionals in law enforcement, we do not feel the pressure from outside sources, be it the media or otherwise, to conduct our investigations.
Yeah, but it's just the fact that it's Waco. Why does he have a Waco ATF shirt? In his head, was he there? Was he involved in the Waco siege and the Branch Davidian cult?
Was his, is that a weird thing he made up about his character? Was his character there?
That's what I'm saying.
And ended up going to fucking Jersey to be a fucking local sheriff?
Did he flee the ATF in disgrace and become a fucking local sheriff? I think that's what he did.
Was that all just some shit that the actor made up for his minute and a half scene?
Yes, I think that's what he did.
In which case, fucking A.
The other actor who I've always been fascinated by is the actor Sam Wells, who plays Sam Woods, the strange filmmaker.
When we have some real dead bodies, then the sharks start circling. Strange that an incident like that would be a prelude to a new phase in my career.
Yeah, he always had that very like 70s creepy filmmaker kind of vibe.
He's wearing his own wardrobe too.
Yeah, I did not feel like someone told him to put that on. I feel like someone told him to show up and that's what he showed up in.
The thing about him is his character is he identifies himself primarily as like a daytime soap director, but the real man, Sam Wells, is a filmmaker. Or at least he was. This is the thing I knew because I was big into the movie in like 99 and 2000. And he made a movie, Wired Angel, Acts of Joan of Arc. He made this movie in 1999. And apparently it's an avant-garde experimental nightmare that's supposedly about the life and times of Joan of Arc. And it played a festival circuit in 1999 and 2000. That's all I know about. That's literally all I know about it. That's all anyone knows about it. Because outside of screening at a handful of film festivals, this thing's never been seen by anyone. It was released in 1999, but it got no distribution. It hasn't screened anywhere else. There's never been a trailer.
I was going to say, unless you have that screener VHS, that shit is gone.
I have to assume that Sam Wells probably still has, like, it was shot on 16mm film. I have a feeling he probably still has.
Has a copy or two of that.
Aside from that, it's basically lost media. It doesn't exist, which drives me nuts because I read the contemporary festival reviews when it came out because I was like, oh, I want to see this movie. It sounds fucking insane.
Like The Room doesn't make sense.
No, I don't. Like I don't mean like
bad
good. I mean it sounds like madness, like something like art. It sounds like fucking art. I'm never going to be able to see this goddamn movie. And it's taken me, I mean, it's been 24 years now. And I can't, I know I'm never going to see this goddamn movie, but it drives me fucking nuts because of that. That's it. I just wanted to share my frustration with you, Kai, and with you, dear listener. There's a movie that was made called Wired Angel, The Acts of Joan of Arc. No one will ever get to see ever because people don't give a fuck.
I mean, what is the truth? Ultimately, with a documentary film, I mean, ultimately it's what the filmmaker perceives as the truth. I mean, don't you think that's what you're trying to do, right?
Probably wrap this up a little bit. I got a few things to say about where the filmmakers went after this, and then we can just end this.
All right, wrap us up here.
Stefan Avalos, not Stephen Avcast, which sounds like the real name. Change your name. Change your fucking name. The two filmmakers parted ways. They're still friends. They still know each other, but they don't work together really anymore. Stefan Avalos went out west. He basically became a Hollywood guy. He's worked pretty regularly. He's worked in various TV shows and some movie projects, does graphic design, visual effects and stuff. He made a feature in 2003 called Ghosts of Edendale, which I watched in 2003. It wasn't shot on film either. In 2003, you could shoot with better professional grade equipment. It's a ghost story, ghosts in old Hollywood, specifically the ghost of Tom Nix, who's a real Western actor. The movie actually deals with the legend of Tom Nix. It's a good movie. It's fine. He made a documentary called Strad Style, which I just heard about this recently. It's about some yokel in Ohio who claims that he could build a perfect replica of a famous Stradivarius violin. That's it. That's the documentary. And I don't know if he does it or not. I don't know if he makes the Stradivarius because I didn't watch it. I guess these days he's involved with a company called, I wrote this down, Array, ARRAY Incorporated. And they develop AI technology for movie and TV projects. Sure. And old Lance Wyler directed a movie in 2006 called Head Trauma, which once again I watched because it was made by one of the Last Broadcast guys. I don't know. It's also a kind of a ghost story. It's about a homeless guy who inherits his late grandfather's house, but the house is dilapidated. It's about to be demolished. So he tries to fix it up to save it, but he hits his head and has a whole bunch of weird visions and some weird shit happens to him. You'd call it a slow burn horror movie, but the movie's good. Lance Wyler, he has an interesting career. He's more interested in what you would call the intersection between storytelling and technology. He's very fascinated by emergent technology. Part of it started with Head Trauma. He incorporated an ARG, an alternate reality game, into Head Trauma that people could play on their own. Helped shepherd a project called Pandemic 1.0 several years ago. Has alternate reality elements to it. One of his most interesting projects was in 2019. An immersive experience called Where There's Smoke. I read it as part art installation, part documentary, and part escape room. It's advertised as allowing patrons to literally walk into a movie. It got rave reviews. Amazingly enough, at least amazingly to me, he collaborated with David Cronenberg and the Toronto International Film Festival to create something called Body Mind Change. Quote, an immersive experience that collects data on the players who are experiencing the story. The story changes, it tailors itself to suit each unique audience. Sounds ambitious and weird and awesome, but also kind of creepy.
Right.
Like you're collecting data points on people so that you're learning about them as they're learning about, okay. This is where, once again, it might be crossing a line, but he's also created these, he co-created what he calls collaborative storytelling experiences. One of them is called Sherlock Holmes and the Internet of Things, and the other is called Frankenstein.ai, premiered in 2018. There's a quote from The Verge, the writer who experienced Frankenstein.ai. So I'm just going to read this quote to you because I want you to try to understand what the fuck this is. Just listen to this.
Frankenstein AI, a monster made by many, intelligently updates Mary Shelley's tale based on modern fears about artificial intelligence.
The main installation was one of my favorite parts of Sundance's New Frontier lineup. It culminates in a large, glowing screen, the titular monster,
asking AI-generated questions to audience members, then using their responses to evolve. But in one-time performance,
also added a live dancer who worked in tandem with the machine.
Her movements were choreographed beforehand.
And whenever the AI analyzed a set of answers, it would formulate a mood that affected her dance, delivering the information via earpiece.
I still have no idea how intelligent or monstrous the AI actually is, or how much it's just a device for heightening our
awareness of physical human interactions, which is arguably one of the most interesting things about the project.
That's it. That's the quote. Try to tell me what the fuck Frankenstein.ai is.
It almost sounds like a reverse AI engine. The AI comes at you with the questions. I guess isn't reverse AI. That's essentially what it is. It allows you to ask the question, but it's also getting the data in the same way.
What I read about Frankenstein AI, it tries to stimulate a conversation with the audience because there's no such thing as an audience with it. It's a collaborative medium. They're part of the show. It's
right. Trying I'm, to get I'm just to imagining, talk to each other. Does the audience have like ABCD beepers? Little screen they can write in the answers?
I've tried to look. There is a website for it. I didn't look at it in detail yet, but there is what seems like a pretty interesting website. It literally is. You can type in your browser Frankenstein.ai and it will take you there. So it still exists. This is a thing that still exists. I'm fascinated by it, but I also don't know what the fuck it is. But hey, this guy's doing weird, interesting stuff out there. The last thing I heard he was working on is what he called, and he was very enthusiastic about this, he calls it a deep fake found footage project. And it's also, once again, collaborating with AI. And he also teaches at the Columbia University School of the Arts. So he's got a full plate.
Oh, no, I'm talking about Steven being a pussy. I'm not talking about Jim being a pussy. Jim's one psycho motherfucker. I'm
scared.
You want to get... Let me get that on. Let me get that for camera.
That thing's running, isn't it?
Of course it's running. Great, we're supposed to record everything.
I think it's interesting that both Lance Wyler and Stefan Avalos independently have started working in the AI field.
That's one of the other weird things about this movie is a lot of it is about technology, even though it's not about technology at all.
Lance Wyler and Stefan Avalos were just two normal people trying to make a movie in a new and innovative way. At the same time, they were trying to show you a new way to make a movie.
You can't make a movie this way right now. I mean, you can, yeah. But now it would be prohibitively expensive.
You could make it on your iPhone. You could probably still make this movie for $900 if you filmed it on your phone.
The point I'm trying to make is that you can be inspired by their example and make something interesting and innovative on your goddamn phone right now.
Yeah.
You can do it. I'm not saying go find some old camcorders at a garage sale and try to make a movie using like old school Adobe Premiere and After Effects on a fucking 1998 PC. Don't do that. Don't fucking do that.
Don't try to use Adobe on Windows 98. You'll want to blow your brains out.
But get inspired by what they've done and
make
try
the,
to make
the modern version of it.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, I don't know what they were looking for. All they were getting was a bunch of bad television.
The last broadcast, the documentary, it's basically a trophy. I don't know. I feel like it's a trophy for David Lee, the filmmaker. He's the real killer. He created this documentary partially because, I mean, as we said before, the actual murders, they faded from the public consciousness. So part of it is him getting it back in the public consciousness. Part of it is also trying to draw attention to himself. He thinks he's a fucking genius. He creates a documentary that basically exonerates posthumously the man he framed for the murders.
The man that he set up for the murder.
Right. He calls out the police specifically for their shoddy investigation.
And that the police case was shoddy at best.
And on top of that, he belittles Jim Seward as basically being a feeble-minded malcontent.
Jim Seward was not responsible for these murders, that he had neither the intellect nor the logical capacity to carry them through.
He builds up the real killer as some sadistic mastermind.
It is as though the real killer planned a media event so amazingly cunning that it could be thought of as scripted.
He's outwitted the cops, and he'll never be brought to justice. All he's doing is stroking his own ego. But like I said earlier, he's also creating the conditions to allow himself to kill again. He's using this pretense of shooting a documentary to interview all these people that are connected to the murders. He's getting off on this. He's also building his own legend and his own reality. I actually think the way the last broadcast is constructed is brilliant. The way Stefan Avalos and Lance Wyler made this movie, the way the context changes completely when you realize the documentarian is the murderer. It's brilliant. And the fact that it still wallows in obscurity, I find incredibly frustrating because this movie does. You know, maybe the movie, they say every movie finds its audience. And maybe this movie was just never meant to attract a wider audience. Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm just bitter because I spent 25 years now, well, 24 years, loving this movie, and I've never heard anyone else talk about it. I don't know. Right. Maybe that's it. And the fact that other people basically don't even know it exists, and if they do, they might think,
didn't it rip off the Blair Witch Project?
Or something like that. That's an answer you'll get from people. I hate it, but I love this movie. I think the last broadcast is kind of amazing.
I've determined that this is no time to be distracted or set aside in the course of the events that I've set into motion.
But now that we've reached the end of this, and I want to say extremely long conversation about the last broadcast, much longer than I assumed it would be, but you know what? That's basically par for the course with Trapo, so fuck. But now that we've reached the end of this conversation, Kai, honestly, what are your thoughts about the movie? What do you think about the last broadcast?
I actually really enjoyed it. Interesting take, an OG in the found footage, even though it's not totally a found footage type movie. But considering this is one of the first ones, it bends the genre before the genre has even been made.
I think it breaks the genre.
And it kind of breaks it in a weird and unique way that you don't see coming. You kind of have to watch it two or three times to understand all of the subtleties of the documentarian covering his own ass. But also, no one knows that, and there's like layers to all that shit. But it's pretty fucking good, and I enjoy it, and it's in the canon.
I'm just fascinated by the idea that this guy has such a huge ego and thinks so highly of himself that he creates a documentary that exonerates the man he framed for the murders.
Right.
But he thinks he's bulletproof. He actually even mentions it, the way the culture has changed. People just want sound bites. They move on from stories so quickly. He probably is fucking bulletproof. He's already gotten away with it, and now he's rubbing it in the world's collective face. How fucking genuinely diabolical is that? Fuck it. It's amazing. I love it. It's in the canon. Yeah. The last broadcast, dear listener, has just been inducted into the Trapo Essentials canon. It's a Halloween miracle.
I don't know. Fuck. But by the time this goes live, maybe this will be the last episode of Trapo. Maybe it will be the last broadcast.
It might be. But yeah, here's the thing, dear listener. Technically, this is our Halloween episode. Next time around, not to spoil things, but do we just tell them that it's a KTRP episode?
It's time for KTRP, and it's back.
If I keep this in the final edit, I will ensure no one will listen to the actual Halloween episode. Statistically speaking, the KTRP episodes are our lowest rated, so man.
Oh, KTRP's next? I'm out.
But that's it for us this time, dear listener, and we just had a conversation. I think you know where this is going, dear listener, because we're going to ask you a question. We want you to be a part of that conversation. It's so fucking easy to do. You know how easy it is to do? It's so fucking
how easy.
But the problem is, it's so easy to do that I think they take it for granted, Kai.
Is it too easy?
It might be too easy.
Should we hide our blog? Like, disguise it and make people try to come find it? We get even less communication.
I think I need to start forwarding the blog to the new address, trapotoilets.blogspot.com. I think it's coming.
Yeah, that's what's really holding us back.
We need to become a dedicated toilet blog, and then we're going to blow the fuck up. Like, the diarrhea in the toilets. But no, don't go to trapotoilets.blogspot.com. I haven't secured the domain yet. But
it's like I'm typing right now. Hold on.
Oh, God. I just saw my future and I hate it. What have I done to myself? Why did I do this? Well, I did it to myself.
I was going to say, this is not prompted.
Anyway, go to traposhow.blogspot.com, traposhow.blogspot.com. Leave a comment. It can be related to the topic at hand. You can tell us about Halloween. Tell us what you think about Halloween, how much you like it, how much you hated our last Halloween episode, because we know you did. Or just tell us whatever you want anymore. We don't care. As long as you're not like a bigoted, transphobic asshole, just leave a comment and leave a name. Don't be anonymous anymore. I'm sick of it. No more anonymous comments.
Come on, anonymous.
I love it. You know what else I love? Fucking email.
Emails? You can send us an email at traposhow@gmail.com. Right. Please do. Tell us what you thought of the show. Tell us what you thought about life. Tell us what you think about death. Tell us what you think about paninis. I don't care. Just send me an email because I want to read it.
No, I'm fucking thinking hardcore about paninis.
I kind of want a panini right now. Anyways, thank you. Thank you for listening. Dear listener, welcome. Oh, shit. Wait, we did that.
No, now we just got to tell them happy Halloween, I guess.
Dear listener, happy holidays, and get the fuck off the internet.
What is the Jersey Devil? What is the Jersey Devil? What is the Jersey Devil? What is the word of the Jersey? What is the Jersey Devil?
Just cut the damn camera already.